7.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, Alex Jennings begins reading Explorers of the Nile, The Triumph and Tragedy of a Great Victorian Adventure by Tim Geale. In the mid-19th century, the whereabouts of the Nile's source was still the planet's most elusive secret. How could the river flow every day for 1,200 miles through the driest desert in the world without being replenished by a single tributary? Over the centuries, many men had died attempting and failing to solve the mystery. Then, between 1856 and 1875, a series of exceptionally brave British explorers would make the perilous journey to the African interior in an attempt to discover the source of the Nile.
In 1856, the Royal Geographical Society commissioned Captain Richard Burton to undertake a voyage of discovery in East Africa. Burton's instructions required him to penetrate inland to the Unknown Lake, which was, of course, only unknown to Europeans. He was then to proceed northwards to ascertain the head source of the Nile, which will be your next great objective to discover. Burton was passionate in his desire to solve the age-old mystery. Man wants to wander, and he must do so, or he shall die, he wrote. He chose for his companion on the journey the man with whom he had already been to Somaliland, John Hanning Speke. Jack Speke's willowy figure, his fair-skinned, fresh-faced good looks, and his assured but reserved manner contrasted strikingly with Burton's swarthy, almost oriental appearance and his dark-eyed, melodramatic presence. Burton, as the more experienced and celebrated traveller, wanted a colleague who would never challenge him. As Speke confided several years later, "Burton is one of those men who never can be wrong and will never acknowledge an error." The two men arrived in Zanzibar in December 1856. Sighting the African coast from the sea, Jack Speke was mesmerised by the white coral sands, vivid blueness of the ocean, and green aquatic mangrove growing out into the tidal waves. A corpse floated near the foreshore, which Burton remarked did not discourage the younger blacks of both sexes from swimming and disporting themselves in an absence of costume which would startle even Margate. The expedition started with Burton committing a major error of judgment. He purchased excellent presents for chiefs, sprigged muslin for turbans, embroidered hats and coats, and white and pink Venetian beads. But regarding the all-important basic trade goods, to be used for buying food and paying for the rite of passage, he later confessed he had made the mistake of ignorance of not laying in an ample store of American fabric and a greater supply of beads. But leaving Zanzibar, Burton felt euphoric. Of the gladdest moments in human life is the departure upon a distant journey into unknown lands. The blood flows with the fast circulation of youth. Excitement gives a new vigour to the muscles. The success or failure of expeditions depended much on the experience and motivation of the African guides, porters and servants. By great good luck, Burton and Speke had managed to employ Sidi Mubarak Bombay, a free African who would become the expedition's principal factotum. Speke asserted that he had never met any black man as honest, generous, and conscientious as he was. In mid-June 1857, preceded by the Sultan's blood-red flag, which was carried at the head of all Zanzibar caravans, the column marched along the coast for several miles before heading westwards into the African interior in search of the lake. Immediately behind them, the main body of porters straggled for several hundred yards, their 70-pound loads chafing backs and shoulders not yet hardened to them. They were carrying not only cloth and beads, but camp beds, chairs, and a chest of scientific instruments. Being used to obedient soldiers, both Speke and Burton found their Nyamwezi porters and their concubines and hangers-on hard to manage. the terrain became increasingly menacing. After 22 days travelling through dense jungle, interspersed with barrens of low mimosa and dreary savannas, the two Britons suffered their first severe attacks of malaria, with the usual headaches, nausea, lassitude, weakness, inability to stand up, and alternating burning heat and freezing cold. They were both so ill, they could only just sit on their donkeys. On paths slippery with mud, they came across columns of black pismire ants, which in no time fastened themselves to the foot or ankle, inflicting bites that burned like a pinch of a red-hot needle. After weeks spent crossing a dusty, lifeless winter jungle, Burton and Speke entered the Arab trading settlement of Kazeh, about 150 miles short of the as-yet undiscovered lakes of Tanganyika and Victoria, to the sound of booming horns and muskets ringing like saluting mortars. They had marched about 600 miles in 134 days. A welcoming party of white-robed Arabs led them to a pleasant tembe, a house with a veranda and inner courtyard, which was placed at their disposal for the duration of their stay. The two men had a letter of introduction to a leading Indian trader, Musa Mzuri, but in his absence, his Arab agent, Snay bin Amir, overwhelmed Burton with gifts of goats, bullocks, tamarind cakes and other delicacies. While Burton was confined to his tembe with fever, Speke learned from the Arabs that there were three lakes rather than one. To the south was Nyasa, Lake Malawi, to the west the Ujiji Lake, Lake Tanganyika, and to the north the Sea of Ukerewe, Lake Victoria, which might be largest of all. Speke was now in favour of visiting the most northern lake, but Burton overruled him in favour of the shorter journey to Lake Tanganyika. Unable to move his limbs, it would be 11 months before Burton would walk unassisted, so until then he had to be carried by six men. At last, on the 13th of February 1858, after a journey of 200 miles, the caravan struggled through tall grass and then climbed a stony hill. As they reached the summit, Speke's ailing donkey died under him. For 2 weeks, Speke had been suffering from ophthalmia, with both eyes inflamed and sore, and his vision so seriously impaired that he needed to be led when riding. Burton now gained his first uninterrupted view of Lake Tanganyika. Fringed by a ribbon of glistening yellow sand, an expanse of the lightest, softest blue, in breadth varying from 30 to 35 miles, and sprinkled by the crisp east wind with tiny crescents of snowy foam. In his state of near blindness, Speke was devastated that the lovely Tanganyika Lake could be seen in all its glory by everybody but myself. Although they were the first Europeans to have reached any of Africa's great lakes, both men knew that a lot more had to be done to confer greatness on their journey. They had already been told that from the northern extremity of the Tanganyika Lake issued a large river flowing northwards. So visiting this river in person was of the utmost importance in case it should prove to be the source of the Nile. On his arrival at Ujiji, on the bank of the lake, Burton was too ill to write or even talk, and lay prostrate on the earth floor of a hut for a fortnight, unable to move his legs. When Burton felt slightly stronger, he told Speke that they would have to hire from Hamid bin Sulayan, an Arab slave trader, the only sailing dhow currently on the lake. Hamid lived on the far side of Tanganyika, so somebody was going to have to cross in a dugout. On the 3rd of March 1858, Speke embarked, accompanied by Bombay to interpret, a cook, two Baluchis to defend him, and 18 local tribesmen to paddle. When harm came to Speke, it was from an entirely unexpected quarter. After landing on Hamid's island, Speke spent a quiet day smoking and storytelling with the locals. At nightfall, he lay down to sleep in his tent. A storm blew up. Speke lit a candle, and in a moment, as if by magic, the whole interior became covered by a host of small black beetles. Although insects crawled up his sleeves, down his back and legs and into his hair, he managed to fall asleep, until woken, as he recalled, by one of these horrid little insects, struggling up the narrow channel of the ear and digging violently away at my tympanum. I applied the point of a penknife to his back, which did more harm than good, for though a few thrusts quieted him, the point also wounded my ear so badly that inflammation set in. I could not masticate for several days and had to feed on broth alone. Not even Speke's offer of £100 could persuade the slaver to hire out his large dhow. Nevertheless, Hamid greatly excited Speke by confirming that a large river called the Rusizi flowed out of the northern end of the lake. Speke had been away for a month, while Burton, whose health was little better, had passed the time chiefly in eating and drinking, smoking and dozing. Yet he saw nothing inappropriate about making fun of an exhausted Speke on his return. I never saw a man so thoroughly moist and mildewed. But when Speke announced that a river flowed out of the northern end of the lake, Burton was ecstatic. Ill though he was, reaching the northward flowing river posed the greatest challenge of his life. Everything, wealth, health, and even life, was to be risked for this prize, Burton declared. This crucial trip began a few days later, with Burton having to be half-dragged, half-carried for 3 miles over rough ground to the point of departure. After 19 days afloat, Burton wrote that he was suffering so severely from ulceration of the tongue that articulation was nearly impossible. This affliction could not have come at a worse time, since on the 28th of April, Burton heard the shocking news from a local chief that the river at the end of the lake, the Rusizi River, despite what Speke had been told earlier, flowed into Lake Tanganyika rather than out of it. All my hopes, confessed Burton, were rudely dashed to the ground. Even though it now seemed all but certain that Lake Tanganyika could have no relationship to the Nile, it remained a matter of vast importance, as Burton conceded, to reach the Rusizi River in person, to see with his own eyes the direction in which it flowed. But now Burton ordered a return to Ujiji, even though only 6 more hours was all it would have taken to reach the Rusizi. According to Speke, Burton's real problem had been a total collapse of his health. While recuperating in Ujiji in early May, Burton refused to try one last time to reach the Rusizi. So Speke diplomatically suggested an alternative. If you are not well enough when we reach Kaze, I will go myself to the northern lake. Burton agreed to this solo trip, but in years to come, in his desperation to make it seem that he had been responsible for initiating Speke's historic journey to what would turn out to be Lake Victoria, he would write for public consumption that he had dispatched him, Speke, from Kaze, to search for the northern lake. Free now to travel north on his own, John Hanning Speke was determined to succeed at whatever cost.
And tomorrow, Alex Jennings reads part 2 of Explorers of the Nile, the triumph and tragedy of a great Victorian adventure.